Well, hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the third chapter, and this is the third part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, where for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast. Now on with the story. Chapter 3, Encounter with the First Gale. Shortly after passing Cape Flattery, the easterly wind acted in just about the same way as it did during the night where the St. Stephen was lost, for it hauled from the east round to the south. However, the weather remaining clear, I knew there was no danger of a storm, and so the Zora was kept by the wind under all sail, taking a southwesterly course. Towards evening, the wind fell light, and when at 9 o'clock the light of Cape Flattery was dipping in the water, the breeze died out, and we were becalmed 19 miles to the southwest. Besides the bright light of the Cape Lighthouse, we saw several other lights from vessels which were also becalmed and drifting around in the same way as the Zora. As we were outside of the track of steamers, we placed a bright light on deck and all three of us went down into the cabin, lit our pipes and talked about our promising future. Mac swore that if he could only get £50,000 sterling out of the Cocos Island treasure, he would be King of Ireland in a very short time. All sorts of castles went up in the air that evening. When I went on deck just before midnight, everything was moist with dew. This being a sure sign in that part of the world of a westerly wind blowing the next day, I went below saying, "Gentlemen, we shall have a westerly wind tomorrow, and as it is nearly midnight, we had better draw for watches, after which the man who draws the first will take the first watch till 2 o'clock, the next man the second watch from 2 till 4, and the third from 4 till 6. "Keep watch for what?" said Mac. "It is dead calm and fine weather, so why not all of us turn in and have a good sleep, the same as we did in Sook Harbour?" I replied, "Nothing of the sort, Mac. We must watch our little vessel now, night and day, while we are at sea." We then drew for watches, and each took his turn. The next morning, at about 11 o'clock, a light breeze came up from the northwest, and the Zora started to go south. The breeze soon freshened, and by 7 o'clock in the evening, the mountain tops of Vancouver Island dropped out of sight. The following 2 days we experienced fine weather with the same wind taking the boat along at the rate of about 175 miles per day. On the following day, the wind suddenly increased, which compelled us to take in one reef after the other, so that at 3 o'clock in the afternoon she was going along under a 3-reefed mainsail at a speed of about 8.5 miles an hour, with the wind dead aft. In spite of some of the seas breaking quite heavily, the Zora steered excellently and went along quite dry. However, knowing from experience in large vessels the danger of running before a high sea with increasing wind force, I thought it better to experiment with the Zora in time, as I did not then know her peculiarities. I well remembered an incident that took place when I was quite a young man on the Canadian bark J.W. Parker. Coming from the west coast of South America with a cargo of nitrate and making for the English Channel with a strong southwesterly gale behind us, the bark steered easily under a main lower and upper topsail, the fore lower topsail and foresail. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when I had been lashed to the wheel together with another seaman, the captain came on deck and, observing the breaking seas behind us and that the vessel remained quite dry, commented on the fact that she was a splendid vessel to run before it. And I certainly believe this also, seeing that the breaking seas, overhauling us at a great speed, passed under our stern with such a roaring noise that it would give me the shivers. However, the vessel would always raise her stern to the occasion, and the sea would pass along without doing any damage. It was a few minutes to 4 o'clock when another large breaker came in. I heard it coming, but men at the wheel are not allowed to look back when a vessel is running hard, so I did not see it approaching. This time, the vessel's stern did not rise quickly enough, in consequence of which the sea broke over her stern with such tremendous force that it did all the damage it possibly could have done, short of sending the ship and crew to the bottom. Owing to the rope with which we two were fastened to the wheel having too much slack, I was washed under the port rail while my mate was hanging overboard, but as the rope was still fastened to him, he was successfully pulled back on board. The cabin doors and the skylight on the cabin were smashed to splinters, and the cabin was full of water. Several doors of the forward house were also smashed, and the same sea that did all this damage caused the vessel to broach too. It appears to me that the ship would have foundered had it not been for the good carpenter who put her together. When a vessel broaches to in a heavy gale, it appears in a few seconds. The deck is filled with water from rail to rail, and the men, if not washed overboard, are unable to attend to any sails quickly enough to save them. At the same time that this was happening to the J.W. Parker, and while the sea was breaking over her weather rail, the few sails which had been left standing blew away. The ship was safe, however, for after losing her sails, she lay broadside onto the wind and sea and was quite comfortable. After the gale moderated, all hands were busy bending new sails, and I heard the first mate, who was an old, experienced seaman, saying, "We can thank God and not our seamanship that we are alive." I have found out during later years that he was perfectly right, and well aware of the great mistake that had been made in running too long. Thinking back over that accident and some other little troubles I had met with at sea, I made up my mind to heave the Zora to at once, and bring her up to the wind with her three-reefed mainsail and a small storm staysail. My mates were standing by to haul in the mainsheet, while I had the tiller, watching my chance to luff her up in as smooth a sea as possible. When I thought that my chance had come, while the boat was on top of a comparatively smooth sea, I put down the helm, the mainsheet was hauled in as quick as lightning, the boat shot round, and before the next sea approached, Zora was sailing by the wind, shipping, however, a big sea over her bow. The centreboard had not been lowered since we sailed into Sook Harbour, and in spite of it being up, the boat would range ahead under the small sails, taking a lot of water on board and making things very unpleasant in general. I then commenced operating with the vessel, trying to place her in such a position as to make her lie comfortably. First, we took in the staysail altogether, in consequence of which the boat shot up into the wind and nearly shook the mainsail to pieces. Then we tried her with the three-reefed mainsail and the centreboard down, regulating her with the rudder so that she would not yaw about, but this also proved a failure. Under the above two trials, the boat kept on forging ahead and would not lay hove to. At the same time, being very wet and unmanageable, sometimes going ahead and sometimes astern, placing us all in imminent danger of foundering. We then hauled up the centreboard, hoisted the staysail with the sheet flat in to windward and the helm halfway down. This fixed her. There she lay from 3 to 4 points off the wind and making almost a square drift to leeward, being at the same time comparatively comfortable. Towards night, the wind increased to a heavy gale, but still the Zora lay quite well and almost dry. However, the vessel would at times shiver from the pressure of the sails, and it became evident that we still carried too much canvas, though we could not make them any smaller, being reefed down entirely. Then I decided to take recourse to a sea anchor, although I had never used one before, so did not know the real value of it. Neither did we have one on board. I proceeded in the following manner. The main boom crutch and some boards from the bunks, about 6 feet long, were tied together with some old canvas into a sort of bundle, and a 40-pound anchor fastened to the same. Then we made a 3-inch rope fast to this improvised sea anchor, dropped it over the weather bow, took in the staysail, and when the sea anchor was about 50 yards away, belayed the end of the line onto the mast. The main sheet being hauled in flat, I certainly expected the boat to swing head to wind as soon as the rope became tight, in which, however, I was very much mistaken. The vessel would sometimes swing almost broadside on against the wind and sea, and under the pressure of the sea, almost turned turtle. We then lowered the mainsail altogether, which proved somewhat a remedy, but we were still not lying quietly enough and shipping water all the time. I was then convinced that the only way to steady her was to hoist a small sail aft, and as we had no mizzenmast, took the storm staysail, bending the tack to the end of the main boom, and unhooking the peak halyard, bent the head of the staysail to it, and hauled the staysail sheet forward instead of aft, thus obtaining a flat fore-and-aft sail over the stern of the boat. The Zora at once swung head to wind and rode as comfortably to her sea anchor as a vessel rides to her mud hook in a landlocked harbour, so that when sitting in the cabin, we could hardly imagine that we were actually experiencing a howling gale at sea with huge breaking seas. The direction of the wind was north-northwest, and the Zora, owing to her poor sea anchor, drifted at a rate of about 1.5 to 1.75 miles per hour to the south-southeast. The gale kept up its fury for nearly 2 days, and it was really a pleasure to see the little vessel, with the help of her sea anchor, mounting those large combers with perfect ease and comfort. When the gale had sufficiently moderated, we hauled the sea anchor on board and, under very small riding sails, kept the boat on her southerly course again. Chapter 4. Hunting Experiences. San Blas. Disappointing News. The wind kept in the northwest. The weather became fine, and by midnight the Zorro was once more under all sail, making her course at the rate of from 125 to 150 miles per day till the 25th of July, when at daybreak Guadalupe Island came in sight about 10 miles distant ahead of us. This island lies about 140 miles off the coast of the northern part of Lower California. It is about 15 miles long and 3 to 5 miles broad. As we approached the island, the wind fell light, but at noon we were about a stone's throw from the shore. The land appeared absolutely barren, with surf breakers all along the coast, so that we did not care to attempt a landing. We, however, followed the coast at as close a distance as rocks and wind would allow, for a person never knows what he may find on an out-of-the-way inhabited island. I was acquainted with a man in Victoria who, by cruising around out-of-the-way places, picked up a piece of ambergris worth $150,000. We were not quite so lucky. We were reaching the south end of the island when we saw a few birds. Otherwise, it seemed quite dead and uninhabited by man or beast. Suddenly, Mac shouted at the top of his voice, "See there! What is that standing on the cliff?" Looking in the direction pointed out by him, we observed a billy goat. We could do with a little fresh meat, so what about launching our dinghy, making for the shore and shooting billy? The sporting fever came over us, but as it was impossible to land there and then, we proceeded south, where we found a nice sandy beach, and Mac and I effected a landing in the dinghy. He carried a rifle and I a shotgun, while Jack took care of the vessel. We directed our course to where we had seen billy when we came across one without horns. Mac shouted, "That is Mrs. Billy, and if she will only stop there for another minute, I shall hook it onto her." Mrs. Billy stopped. Mac fired but missed, and our feast had vanished. Mac was very much annoyed at missing the goat and asked me to take the rifle while he would play dog, but on my remonstrances, he at last consented to try again on the next opportunity. We proceeded, and shortly afterwards found a goat lying beneath a small tree. Was he dead or only asleep? We carefully approached, keeping our guns in readiness, but drawing nearer, saw that Billy was only taking a nap. Mac insisted upon taking him alive. Before I could reply, he had seized him, and Billy, getting on his feet, struggled for life. If I could have taken a moving picture of what happened during the following few minutes, I should have made my fortune on the spot. It was just a toss-up between the two as to who would come out second best, but at last Mac got both his arms round Billy's neck and held on like grim death. I shouted to Mac to let the goat go and I would shoot him, but he objected, claiming that if he did, the goat would butt into him. Finally, the goat managed to extricate himself from Mac's grip and sped away. I fired a shot, but missed, fired again, but hit the same place, and Billy got safely away. Owing to the treasure fever, we did not want to lose any more time, and went back to our boat. Zora was anchored about 150 yards from the shore, and while we were away, Jack had shot a Mrs. Billy from the deck of the vessel. We took it on board and enjoyed fresh meat for several days. Soon after our return to the vessel, we weighed anchor and made for Acapulco, a distance of about 1,200 miles. The weather kept fine and the wind light, and we were about 50 miles distant from Cabo San Lucas, the southern end of the Californian Peninsula, when we drifted about for 2 days in a dead calm amongst a lot of turtles. The turtles proved much easier victims than the goats on Guadalupe Island. We launched our little dinghy and got near them with our rifles. There was a great deal of driftwood floating about, and some turtles would play with pieces of wood, not taking the slightest notice of our approaching boat, till the bullet came. We shot several of them, and considerably augmented our stores thereby. During the following few days, we had a light southwesterly wind, and with it made Cape Corrientes, but when about 15 miles offshore, we got becalmed again. At about 2 o'clock that afternoon, dark and threatening clouds rose over the high mountain tops along the Mexican coast. "There is something behind that," I said, But Mac was of a different opinion, replying, "I don't think so. Look at the barometer. It has remained steady for the last fortnight." "That barometer is worse than Tom Pepper," Jack said, "and you know what happened to him." "I myself, upon receiving a warning from nature," and these threatening clouds were of course a warning to seamen who, from experience, take notice of such phenomena, "put my vessel into such trim as to be ready for the expected storm. Having plenty of sea room and it being absolutely calm, I lowered all sails and waited for the blow." The clouds were coming from the southeast, and in moving towards us were increasing in size. I was watching them from the cockpit, when at about 4 o'clock the first ripple appeared on the water, and after a few minutes we were in the midst of a thunderstorm of the worst kind. Owing to the storm approaching with such force, I thought it would soon pass over, but was very much disappointed. It kept up with the same fury, hour after hour, and to make matters worse, the wind veered round to the southwest, blowing right on shore. When we lost sight of the land, we were about 15 miles off the coast, which meant that by putting the vessel under a sea anchor, we should be blown ashore in about 9 hours, if the gale continued. We consequently decided to set sail, and everything being strong and new, besides the boat being powerful enough to be pressed, we set the 3-reefed mainsail and the storm staysail, lowered the centreboard, and the Zora crawled off the lee shore, with her deck under water and green seas breaking over the weather rail. The thunderstorm kept up its full force till 11 o'clock, when it abated, and the wind also moderating, we tacked ship and stood towards the land. At midnight all rain and clouds had disappeared, and a most beautiful starlit night followed. A light southwesterly breeze was taking us under full sail back to where we started at the beginning of the storm. However, the breeze soon died away, and we drifted about in a calm in exactly the same way as on the previous day. The weather kept fine, although there was not a breath of wind till at about 2 o'clock the next afternoon, when, to our surprise, we observed the same spectacle as on the day before. Dark, heavy clouds rose over the mountains and came towards us, the barometer acting in the same manner as before. At 4 o'clock, the first catspaw appeared, and soon we were once again close-reefed in a thunderstorm making for the open. The night was exactly the same as the previous one, and as the old saying is, all things come thrice, we had a similar experience on the third night. We had quite enough of it, and steered for San Blas, which we reached 2 days afterwards. No sooner had we dropped anchor than 4 Mexicans came alongside with a boat, and one of them, a pilot, boarded our vessel. "What are you doing here at this time of the year?" he asked, and without waiting for our answer, explained that all their large vessels were laid up on shore on account of the tempestuous weather they were having. "How dare you come here at this time in your little speck of a boat, when all our big craft are laid up for fear of getting smashed in the gales that now rage on our coast? You must take your yacht up the river to safe anchorage, otherwise you will be driven on the rocks," he said. Thinking of our 3 nights' experience, we followed his advice and took the boat up the river, where neither sea nor wind could harm her. We stayed a fortnight in San Blas, during which I found that the old pilot was right. All vessels were laid up from July till October, owing to the rough weather prevailing. But we learned, to our great regret and disappointment, that Mr. Hafner had lately died of fever in Acapulco. We held a consultation to decide whether to carry on alone or give up on the trip. We all had the treasure fever developed to the highest degree, and what, after all, was the use of coming all the way here, only to turn back when Cocos Island was but 1,800 miles further. Besides, I had Hafner's chart of the island printed on my brain, so as to say, and felt certain I could remember the cross-bearings marked on the chart, which led to the spot where the hidden treasure lay. While at San Blas, we experienced many more thunderstorms, similar to the 3 we had already sampled, and on our very last night on the river, a sloop of about the same size as our boat and anchored not far from us was struck by lightning and split from stem to stern. The next morning, we weighed anchor in fine weather, but before going any further, I must say a few words about this beautiful place, San Blas. It is a small Mexican town with about 3,000 or 4,000 inhabitants. The old pilot was the only one who spoke English. There is a fine freshwater stream coming down the mountains on both sides of the town and abounding with alligators and other reptiles. The beach is covered with fine white sand, which apparently is the finest breeding ground for sandflies in the world. Between these and the mosquitoes, which are represented by many millions and our most lusty insects, it was pretty warm for us, to say the least. Those insects acted as if they had never had a square meal in their lives. The weather was just about the same at that time we were there as during the 3 nights off the coast, and Mac admitted that San Blas must have been about the last place the Lord had created. Jack, however, as a more experienced man in that line, said it must actually have been the first, and had therefore been greatly improved upon since. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next installment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly, and remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.